for us, but like your favorite Michael Barkowski?
No, you didn't like microbiology? Seriously? Because microfish was also a nightmare. Hey, everybody! Welcome to another edition of Irreplaceable Truths, where I sit down with amazing guests and we talk about lessons we've learned the hard way, because basically they really aren't brought up in vet school. So I'm here today with Dr. LaBelle. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
I am very good. Dr. LaBelle has been out for 5 years. Really cool. You went to vet school in Australia.
I did. It was very unexpected. That wasn't part of my life plan. But yeah, I decided to apply to most American schools. I applied to 18 schools, mostly American schools. And then I got in to the University of Sydney, and they have opposite school year. So they told me that I got in. I had a month to put down my deposit and move there blind. Had never been to Australia before. And then I moved.
So you left before you graduated USD?
No, I graduated, but they start school in January.
Because it's summer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
And their toilets flush opposite direction, too, if I'm not mistaken.
I never noticed that.
You didn't notice that?
Oh. No, I'm going to have to check next time I'm there. Yeah. But I didn't notice that.
So how was the education there?
I thought it was really, really good. We got a lot of hands-on experience from day one. So we had practicals with horses, sheep, cows, pigs, from day one, chickens as well. So I thought from the hands-on practical experience, it was very, I don't know, I just thought I felt very well-versed in that by the time that I got out of vet school. And I don't know how other vet schools are, but we didn't get to track small or large animal. We had to do everything. And I also don't know how other vet schools do it, but our first year was kind of anatomy. Second year was pathology. And then practical year, essentially.
Yeah, so well, I mean, some people call me a dinosaur now, but back in the day when in so... Ours was the very basically, first year was all the normals.
Uh-huh.
Second year was all the abnormals.
Oh.
Third year was technical. Mm-hmm. And then fourth year was clinical rotations.
Okay.
I'm really interested because obviously I told you I'm working on my dissertation. I'm kind of looking at, you know, are we accepting the wrong students?
Mm-hmm.
I'm really interested. I really didn't look into Australian models because I would love to go to Australia and do research. It's not feasible to do in 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
How were they at teaching the soft skills in Australia?
Soft skills meaning?
Client communication.
Oh.
Emotions.
You know, client communication, one of my favorite classes that we had. Because they hired actors to come in, and we did a whole, they had a whole character analysis that the actors came in and, you know, performed their character. And so we did a lot of mock consults. So I did feel like, I mean, I loved it because, you know, it was a good time for me. But I would say.
But what the listeners don't know is you were into acting and you actually, yes, thought you were going to be a newscaster. That's what your dream was.
Yeah, it was.
So you probably totally got into the role.
Yeah, I loved it. And you could tell what they were just so good at their character. So they tried to kind of, you know, trick you into, okay, are they going to like take you on this path of telling you about their divorce? And then you were graded on, could you bring them back to the consult, you know, and ensuring that you were communicating effectively. Anyway, so I loved that. But I would say from an emotional standpoint, the only, I guess, emotional of anything that we got would be suicide prevention, which I guess I had heard that now they do it in every vet school.
I don't know if they do question, persuade, refer in every vet school.
Okay.
But it's definitely something that, for example, Mentor Vet or Ready Vet Go is something that they offer to all their mentees. Mm-hmm. And they have to take a QPR class to become a mentee in the program. Mm-hmm. To be a mentor in those programs, which I am, you also have to become QPR certified. Which is crazy because, you're like I said, dinosaur over here, I never thought that that was a conversation we needed to have in the profession. Because I grew up in the profession in the, you know, early 2000s, in the teens, and it was like the roaring 20s back then. It was amazing. It was so much fun. It was hard to get a veterinary job because there were so many veterinarians out there that just love what they're doing. Hmm. There was a lot of people that decided, you know, this is going to be my career path, and a lot of people are applying to vet school. They also, things changed with the Great Recession in 2008. Mm-hmm. Then all of a sudden, a big topic became compassion fatigue.
Yeah.
We never discussed burnout. And then burnout became a topic around 2013, 2014. Then obviously COVID, it was the match that went onto the gasoline fire. You know, you put this pile of wood, you put gas all over it, and it just exploded. And I look at veterinary medicine a lot like nursing. I think nursing obviously is another amazing profession. Mm-hmm. And I think they also have the same emotional fatigue that we do because they're so involved with the families and the patients. So things have changed a lot. And that's why I was just interested in this Australian model, because quite honestly, we very rarely have Australian trained veterinarians that you meet. And I feel lucky to actually have one that I can talk to right now. So you graduate Australia and you decide to come back home to Southern California.
Yeah. My dad's one rule in me going to school in Australia was that I was not allowed to meet and marry an Australian man. So I had to come home.
So you had to come home. And that's funny because a lot of women find Australian men very attractive. Mm-hmm. And it's the accent. It's everything.
It's the accent. Yeah.
It is. Accent, yeah. Yeah. You know, My wife during undergrad, she went and did a semester there, and she loved it.
Sydney too?
South of Sydney, and she absolutely loved it. I think if anyone gets a chance to go to Australia, it's incredible. The people are so amazing.
And it wasn't a huge culture shock either. You know, going there, it's fairly similar to San Diego in terms of, you know, how they live their life and such, and obviously they speak the same language and everything. So for, you know, living abroad purposes, I would say it wasn't super, you know, culture shocky for that time. And moving there blindly, never being there before. So beautiful country for sure.
So in one word, when you're ready to graduate, how would you describe your preparedness?
I guess the one word that's coming to mind is just ready. But I felt, and to be fair, I was put into my very first job. I immediately started working by myself. So it was kind of sink or swim, you know? And I hear that story a lot. I don't think I'm alone in that. I felt really prepared. And I felt really, like, eager, I would say. Maybe eager is a better word. To just start making money. That was a big one. And I felt really passionate, even leaving vet school and spending 4 years learning and training. I still had such a passion for animals jumping into my very first day and my first year. I was just, I mean, and I started around COVID time. So it's interesting hearing you kind of define the different seasons of vet med that you've been through. But that's kind of how I started. So it's very different for me. That's kind of where, that's all I know.
Yeah. So you were put into your first job without anyone there.
There were, but my situation, everybody was more of a senior vet than me, at least I think 8 to 10 years out, and nobody wanted to work Saturdays. So I was working Saturdays by myself for the most part. There was another vet that had owned the clinic before it got bought out by corporate that would come and mentor me when he could on Saturdays. But then I was pretty alone pretty quick out of the gate. So
did you have any mentoring at this first job? If you were to look back honestly now.
Yeah. A little bit. Not what I would have wanted. I could always ask for help, but the kind of mentoring that, and the kind of mentor I would want to be to somebody straight out of vet school, no, I did not have that. And I also don't feel alone in that either when I talk to a lot of vets.
Right. Well, I mean, mentoring is a huge, huge piece because mm-hmm. when you do graduate and, you learn a lot, right? You learn a lot in vet school, but mm-hmm. you have all this knowledge, but then all of a sudden you got to put it into practice.
Yes. Yes.
And you're like, holy cow, because mm-hmm. you come out of vet school, you think prednisone is going to kill an animal.
Yes.
You think that
100%.
you think everything's Cushing's.
Everything's Cushing's.
And that's you funny. Know, and the biggest thing I used to see with a lot of the early career vets is they'd be looking for zebras and miss all the horses.
Yeah.
Right? So true. So true.
You know, diarrhea. It's like everything under the sun except Giardia.
Exactly. Oh my gosh, yeah. Bloody diarrhea.
Pancreatitis.
Oh, right now, yep. And you're giving always give the owner a guarded prognosis, no matter what.
Yeah.
That's what my partner taught me coming out of vet school. He would like write down in the chart infectious tracheal bronchitis, guarded prognosis. And I'm like, really? You're putting guarded prognosis for kennel cough? And he's like, gee, if they get better, you look like the hero.
Hey, that's actually a good point.
Right? And you're not overselling yourself.
Yeah.
But it's also a lot. So this first setting, was it emergency?
No, I never did emergency. I don't feel like I would have felt ready for that.
So it was general practice?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, general practice.
And how many vets were there total?
I was the fourth that came on.
Okay, so because you went into this multi-doctor practice, did you feel as if you had three other doctors that truly wanted to mentor you?
No.
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 And that's another misconception I believe a lot of these young professionals are having is like, oh, I'm going to go to a veterinary hospital because it has all these doctors.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need a lot of doctors to mentor you. You need one doctor to mentor you. And I've always also made the argument that if you are going to get a very good mentor that will be there, have their cell phone on, no matter where they are, always be there and available to answer your questions mm-hmm. and hold your, I don't want to say hold your hand, but like the see one, do one, teach one
mm-hmm.
idea, you really don't need an internship.
Yeah, I could not agree more. I think that's so true. There was one doctor there that I did feel like I could ask her anything and she really did want to teach. But when she wasn't there, I didn't feel as safe, you know.
Yeah, because the mentorship has many different layers.
Mm-hmm. Coaching, did you do one?
Huh?
Did you do one?
Did I do? I have a mentor?
No. Did you do an internship?
No, I did not. Mentors coming out of undergrad were mm-hmm. so amazing to me.
Wow.
They knew I wanted to go to vet school. So they took me under their wing. They taught me how to talk to clients. They taught me how to truly explain estimates, treatment mm-hmm. plans, the cost of care. They taught me how to talk to them on the phone. Mm-hmm. They taught me how to break bad news to them. I still remember clear as day is I put on a prescription, please give for pain. And they're like, no, 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 it's not pain, it's discomfort. Just like simple words like that.
Subtle, yeah, differences. Yeah.
So, I mean, I felt as if I was prepared.
Mm-hmm.
And on the business side, I was prepared because my father had his PhD in economics. So since I could walk, I was brought around business. So the business part was easy. And, I mean, we won't even talk about the business piece.
I don't know anything about that.
Exactly.
And we were not taught that.
And, yeah, you weren't taught that at all, which is scary.
It is scary.
Because if I asked you what a P&L is, would you even know?
Profit, loss.
Oh, that's good. So why is it important? Okay,
you
exactly.
Know what you're making
exactly.
And what you're
losing. So that's a whole different podcast. We'll talk about that later. But I mean, it's important that you understand the business piece because negotiating your first contract.
I was just going to say, as simple as I wish they would have just said, like, here's the market right now. This is what you need to ask for in a contract. This is what you look for. You know, these huge sign-on bonuses, you know, something along those lines would have been so helpful. Because you don't know what you don't know.
And those sign-on bonuses are scary because they do, because they lock you in.
Yeah.
Because if you don't stay the full length of your contract, you owe part of it or all of it back. And guess
and
what? The federal government takes a lot of it at first. Yeah. And if you're in California, you lose another 14% of it.
Yeah.
How are you going to pay that back? So you're stuck in a position.
Yeah.
So my recommendation, especially when people, after we were bought out by corporate, was when they were bringing veterinarians in, don't take the signing bonus.
Yeah.
Don't take this. And it's so easy to say because, I mean, we're all in a lot of debt when we come out, right? But don't take on that sign-on bonus because you're locked.
You are locked.
And also be very careful where they go because, like you could be thrown into a situation where way too early you're there by yourself, and way too early, you feel as if you don't have mentorship. So how long did you last at that first job?
I was there, I think, almost 2 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you were, so what would you say was the most difficult thing you had to learn in those first 2 years?
I think just honestly the normal stuff and like kind of how exactly you described it, where I'm not flipping through the entire textbook of vet med in my head of it could be this or this, and just seeing more of the normal day-to-day stuff and how you treat it and just the almost the normal easy medicine stuff that you do every day. That was really hard. And I think I was in a position too where I really wanted to prove my worth. So I was just doing the most, trying to see the most clients, make the most client connections, seeing the most patients, you know, doing the most. And I did get really burnt out really quick.
Right.
So,
well, you got burnout probably because you're emotionally exhausted.
Yeah.
And did you have a lack of self-worth? Did you feel like you were making mistakes? Did you go home and beat yourself up over cases?
Yes. And yeah, I did. And there was one specific one. There was a cat that I lost. I was doing really cheap spay and neuters for a cat rescue, and everything went great during surgery. Cat woke up, then all of a sudden started having horrible diarrhea, started seizing, and died. And I beat myself up for months over that, and I didn't really know what to do.
We all have that case, though.
Yeah.
You everyone will have that one case that they remember clear as day.
Mm-hmm. It was my first loss. Yeah.
It was, your first loss?
Yeah.
Yeah. And unfortunately, with medicine, it happens more and more and more because we haven't perfected it yet. And those are things, I mean, and remember, there's nothing routine about a routine cat spay, a routine dog spay, a routine castration.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing routine about it. You don't know how they're going to react to pain meds, anesthesia, anything.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know if they're going to throw a clot for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. You don't know if they're going to bleed out. You don't know if your ligature is going to slip. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember the first few years. Wow, I would be checking gum color. I would have the technicians or myself check gum color at every 15 to 20 minutes.
Yeah.
Just because, you know, you get that gut feeling.
Mm-hmm.
Do you trust your gut feeling? Do you think your gut feeling is 100% on?
100% on.
Whether it comes to cases or clients?
Yep.
Yeah.
And I've learned that. It's been there, and I haven't always listened to it, but this job has taught me to listen to my gut always, and it's always right.
Yeah. And there's another thing you have over me is that I've learned that the female intuition is almost spot on. I just wish the female intuition would give me lotto numbers to choose.
Right.
So that would be awesome. and then it would be cool because then I would actually, if I won the lottery, I would actually, and people think I'm crazy, I would go open up a vet clinic basically at cost or free. If I had that money, it would be so much fun. If the cost of care was never brought up in veterinary medicine, I think the profession would be phenomenal.
Right. It's such a unique profession in that way, too, where you are a doctor, but there's no healthcare system in place, so people can't afford stuff. It's a constant conversation of money, and it's really brings in such an ethical issue daily with so many cases. Okay, this is going on. I want to run all these diagnostics to figure out what's going on. You can't give them an answer because they can't afford it. And you're just kind of treating symptomatically and hoping for the best, you know?
Right. Well, always give the gold standard.
Of course.
And then you work from there.
Mm-hmm.
Does every diarrhea case need a fecal blood mm-hmm. work, x-rays, you know, yada, 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 yada? No. Ultrasound? No.
No.
There's nothing wrong with like, hey, we're just going to go ahead and treat it.
Mm-hmm.
Bland diet. We'll give you some meds.
Mm-hmm.
I know metronidazole is a faux pas now.
Yeah.
It is a big faux pas, but I mean, what these specialists don't understand is clients come to you because they don't want to get up at 3 a.m. anymore for diarrhea. But, you know, probiotics, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, it takes 6 to 8 weeks for probiotics to fully kick in. So probiotics while you're giving antibiotics makes no sense.
Mm-hmm.
But those are things you learn, mm-hmm. right? So your first 2 years at your first job.
Mm-hmm.
What was the most shocking thing you learned?
Ooh, how people grieve. It's such a wide spectrum of how people grieve and how people deal with loss. That was really, really shocking and very surprising. Some clients really wanting a hug after, some clients completely shutting down, some clients not wanting to be there when you're saying goodbye to their pet, some sobbing hysterically over their pet. You know, it's so, yeah, it's a huge thing that we have to be a part of so often. And you really have to read the room on what people want. And sometimes they don't even know what they want.
So reading the room
mm-hmm.
is probably the biggest soft skill you need to learn.
Mm-hmm.
And that's due to emotional intelligence.
Yeah.
Do you think you had emotional intelligence going in, or do you think you've learned it along the way?
I think I had it going in, and I do feel very lucky.
Yeah.
With that.
'Cause,
but I've also been in therapy my whole life, basically. So.
Oh, you have? Yeah. Oh, man, in micro doses.
I don't think there's been a time that I have not been in therapy since I was like 14.
And do you believe that makes it harder to be a good practitioner?
I think that there's this side that, you know, I hear in therapy when they're like, set a boundary at work around this. And then there's this veterinary side of me that's the whole profession is this extreme outpour. And I feel like that's an expectation as a vet, is giving and giving and giving. And So I think therapy is a great reminder for me to continuously pour back into myself. But I think it's also fighting against this whole profession of people that work so hard and they don't put back into themselves. Does
so
that
when,
make sense?
So when you set boundaries, though, do you believe you, because the one thing I've learned through my research is that when you talk about emotional labor, there's deep emotional labor and there's mm-hmm. surface acting, which is faking a smile. Mm-hmm. Do you believe you have to be careful with your boundaries and not fake that smile because you're setting your boundary and not letting those people truly in? Do you ever have those cases where you just walk in there and you're like, man, I just don't really want to mess with these people, and you fake what you're doing?
Yeah, you kind of have to some degree. And yeah, I mean, there are those clients that you see that name and you're like, oh, I can't deal with them today. But I think the boundary is almost an internal one of, okay, I'm going to give this person 10 minutes of my time, you know, to discuss this, whether it's like a client phone call or, you know, or the 30-minute consult or whatever. And maybe there's a more reasonable boundary that's, you know, when they try to make me refill this medication and bully me into it, I'm going to stay firm in that and not give in to it just to appease them and make them happy, you know, stuff like that, you know?
Perfect. So looking back at your first 2 years, mm-hmm. what one challenge completely changed your trajectory of how you practice?
That's actually a really good question. I don't think I learned. I probably did learn something, but I was so burnt out. I just wanted to leave. And so I just quickly left thinking anything was going to be better than that. And so I don't know if I really took anything super valuable from
the first job.
One to the second.
Gotcha.
And I just kind of made a rash decision to leave. It was like a final straw situation, left, and then found something that wasn't corporate, thinking that was going to be significantly better. And I didn't do a lot of internal processing at that point to figure out how I was going to be different in that next job.
So for the listeners, how did you know you were feeling burned out? How would you describe what you were going through?
I started just not wanting to go to work as much in the morning. It felt a lot harder to get up in the morning. Felt a lot harder to get through a work day. 10 hours seemed almost impossible to get through. And then I started having these weird, I would just be sitting at my desk, nothing happening, not a emergency, come out here doctor situation, just fully sitting at my desk, and my heart would just start racing.
Anxiety attack.
Yeah.
I used to have those. Once I sold my practice to corporate, they got rid of the manager and the entrepreneur hat, and I was just a practitioner, and then boom, it hit me. I would have the worst anxiety in rooms. Like, I would be like, how do I get out of here?
Yeah.
How do I get out of this room? I cannot handle dealing with this client. I don't want to see this client. The dog is amazing. The cat's amazing. The bird's amazing, you know, whatever. But
yeah.
I don't want to be in here. Mm-hmm. I just want to go work on this animal. I don't want to talk to this person anymore. Mm. That's when I knew I had a problem.
Yeah. Yeah. And it sucks.
Now, do you think because you were going through therapy, you were able to read your signs a lot easier than someone who's never experienced therapy?
Yes. I do think that has been a tool that has been of great value to me. That when I started having the panic attacks, though, I felt so out of control. Every skill that I had learned in therapy wasn't even enough at that point to take myself down to a okay, we're okay, we're safe, we're good. And that was actually my first time seeing a psychiatrist, and I got prescribed gabapentin to take, like, with those anxiety attacks. That just kind of, like, took the edge off to just make me, like, relax a little bit, that I could see straight. It was almost like seeing black. Like, I was just like, oh, my God. Like, the world felt like it was caving in, and I would just, like, couldn't catch my breath. Yeah. Terrible. So scary. And then I felt like that kind of gave me that, and then realizing, okay, this is just not a healthy work environment for me. I don't feel safe with the people here. I don't feel like I'm even in a place that I can do my job in the way that I want to. That kind of just was the, and I didn't feel like I had anybody that I could go to that would listen to me if there was a problem. So that kind of just pushed me.
Yeah, mental health is no joke. And mm-hmm. I was not a believer in therapy mm-hmm. until while I was at Pepperdine. They actually, well, they say it's free, but it's actually included in your tuition. They actually had therapy that you could sign up for. Mm-hmm. And I knew I was going to retire. And I was like, you know, and I'm going to do my dissertation on, you know, at that point, I was just looking at, you know, I'm just looking at stress now, but I was going to look at burnout and all that. And I was like, let me sit through this. It was the most rewarding thing I think I ever have done, because yeah. they were able to tell me, this is what you're going to go through when you retire. Mm. This is what's going to happen. And they were spot on with everything they said. You know, the when I retired, I immediately lost my whole identity, right? I was still Dr. G. They can't take my title away, but I was not Dr. G, you know, the veterinarian for Laguna Beach. I was not Dr. G, the people that they could text me, email me, ask questions. Mm-hmm. I wasn't there anymore to take care of those clients that I have fallen in love with. Mm-hmm. Even the clients, and I wasn't there to deal with the clients that I couldn't stand, but that was very hard. And actually, they told me that they're like, you're going to probably get a little depressed, but you're going to be more argumentative. You're going to be very frustrated, and it's going to take about 3 months. Mm-hmm. And they didn't lie. 3 months in, I'm like, holy cow, I got to get back to work. But after that, I was like, oh, this is awesome. This is so cool after 3 months. But then that's when I realized I was still looking for fulfillment. Mm-hmm. And that's where the concept of this podcast came in. And also the other podcasts I'm doing for pet owners, mm-hmm. Irreplaceable Tales, because I want to still give back. I definitely want to give back to the profession. I want to give back to the early career veterinarians, because without all of you, our profession's done, yeah. right? And it is so heartbreaking to me to read, even if you go down Reddit, which, by the way, Reddit totally banned me for life. Because I was responding to people. They're like you read this story, like, oh, I've been out for 18 months and this is not the profession for me. I'm thinking about leaving. And it's just like, and people were writing stupid stuff. And I'm like, no, we need you. Mm. What do you need for help? And they banned me. So, but I still go through the Reddit scrolls just to read about, you know, and it's like at least one or two posts a day. Mm-hmm. Talking about early career professionals in the veterinary profession mm-hmm. that are done.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And I think something that you said that's so valuable is you needed fulfillment, and it was your identity to be a veterinarian. And I think that's kind of, that's so perfectly phrased, where that's kind of how this profession is it's all-encompassing. It's so consuming. It's physically draining. It's mentally draining. It's mentally draining. It's energetically draining. And I feel like having purpose or an identity of some kind outside of being a veterinarian is so, so important, so imperative to mental health.
Well, this is, you know, I think the mental health piece is huge. Mm-hmm. Now, you left that practice. Mm-hmm. You went to a new practice.
Yes.
How long were you there?
That one was about a year and a half.
Was the grass greener?
No. Not at all. Not at all.
Was it the culture of the practice? Was it the doctors that were there? What was it that just gave you that answer right now?
It was just false promises that were made. It was a private practice situation, and I thought that I was going to have a mentor, and it was just going to be him and me. And as soon as I came on, he was gone, and the whole practice was basically left to me once again.
Gone meaning he didn't work anymore? Or
yeah,
gone meaning
absentee
like
owner.
Like, I have someone here now to cover me.
Right.
I'm gone.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That you hear about that all the time, too.
Yeah.
That happened at my first job right out of vet school here in Southern California.
Mm-hmm.
And I had him put in writing in our contract. He's like, if you build our gross by $500,000, I'm going to give you 30% of whatever gross you bring in as a bonus.
Dang.
And guess what? So what does that mean for me? Grind, right? Let's go. He started coming in at 10 a.m., then he started coming in at noon, then he started coming in at 2 mm-hmm. because he saw the numbers. And that is something that, again, the mentorship, the lying, because, and it's just a few bad grapes that destroy the whole bunch.
And, I mean, at the same time, I fully understand he was probably feeling so burnout himself, and he's like, you know, I got somebody in here to do this. I don't have to do it anymore, you know? So I try to, you know, flip the script and kind of look at it from his perspective as well, because I can't say, I mean, I do love teaching, though. I find a lot of value in that. But people that don't, and they just want to be an absentee owner, like, I can't blame them, you know? So...
Well, if they've been at it 25, 30 years, it's understandable.
Yeah.
But if you give someone your word,
that
goes on your character.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you can be politically correct, but I mean, it is a bunch of bullcrap what a lot of these corporates promise,
mm-hmm.
a lot of these private practice promise.
Yeah.
So now you're out 3.5 years. You are mm-hmm. totally down and out on this profession.
Mm-hmm.
What's your next move?
Then I went to another practice. I don't know if you've heard of Curo
mm-hmm.
before. Okay. So it's kind of like a hybrid, private and corporate-ish, essentially. So they approached me to actually offer me a hospital of my own, but I didn't feel called to do that at the time, and I just bought a house, so that just wasn't in the cards for me at that moment. But they said, well, we offer this to somebody else who is right down the road from you, so if you wanted to be their associate, then, you know, you could do that for 2 years and we'll reoffer you a hospital again. So I took that, and I will say that him and I was so aligned with his medicine, great mentor, you know.
So it took you 3.5 years to find this?
Yes.
Okay. I just want the listeners to understand, 3.5 years
yeah.
is how long,
is
it
long
took
time.
You.
Yeah.
But no, if you're not in the right place
mm-hmm.
and you're not getting that mentorship, go look somewhere else.
Yeah.
There's a lot of open jobs.
There are a lot of opportunities, and I think people don't really understand that either. They get sucked into, you know, or they start listening to, oh, you're never going to find anything better than this, you know, you get paid well, blah blah blah. So but yeah, so I actually really did enjoy that job. It was a brand new hospital, so we were a bit slower, you know, just starting up, but all in all, at that point, I think I wasn't there that long. I think only like a little less than a year. But I was doing a lot of soul searching at that time and kind of, you know, I was kind of jumping from these jobs thinking like, it's going to be different. It's going to be different. It's going to be different. And I still wasn't feeling the same want to go to work every day. It wasn't the same love for the job that I had when I first came out of vet school. So through, you know, just really taking some time to, what do I want my life to look like? And one thing that I really decided that I love a lot is travel. And that's something that I just want to do a lot more of. So, unfortunately, you know, my boss at that time, he couldn't offer that much PTO. And then I asked him about unpaid time off, and he said that that wasn't something that he could do, which I understood. So we parted very amicably, and it actually worked out because he had another associate that wanted to come on, and she was looking for a full-time that he knew. So we kind of flip-flopped, and that's when I decided to do relief, and it's been bliss ever since, or much better, I would say.
Do you believe you've had enough mentoring to get you ready for relief work?
Yeah.
Do you put any limitations on your relief work?
In terms of?
What you will not do.
Yeah. I decided I don't love surgery. I really.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah. I gave it my best college try for a while. I've done all the, you know, foreign body, leg amputation, entropion, episioplasty, spay, neuter, whatever. But I just, it's really the anesthesia for me. I feel like if I had a specialist with me running the anesthesia, I would feel really...
Like a licensed RVT.
Yes. Yeah. No, well, not even that. I'm... Or
you want an anesthesiologist in the room?
Or somebody that has worked in anesthesia in an anesthesia department, like at a specialty hospital, and really knows it, that would make me feel a lot more comfortable.
Well, then there are unicorns, I guess, because yeah. what it is you just, the problem I have, because I've been tampering with the idea of doing relief,
mm-hmm.
I just don't know what the model would be like, because if I walked into a place, I'd probably walk right out. If the culture's bad, if they don't have enough support staff, if the place is dirty, if, you know, their equipment is dated, they don't have any equipment. Because, I mean, I'm pretty sure you can tell me some horror stories right now of practices that you've done relief at and you're like, never again.
Yeah. And I have my own contract, so... You know, it's pre-signed, and I have, you know, stipulations about certain things. But, yeah, I mean, there have...
So what are the stipulations that you feel you needed?
Well, I do... The surgery was a big one because I didn't start out that way. I was open to surgery at first, but then I did walk into some places that they don't have, you know, the blood pressure machine. They don't have the bear hugger. They don't have the CO2 monitoring, and that just doesn't make me feel comfortable, and it's not worth my license. So, you know, that was a big one for me. You know, getting paid in a certain time frame, because some corporations feel differently about that. Let's see. I mean, I'll have to show you my contract later, but there's a lot of things that have also like evolved from, you know, I learned
lessons
that I
learned
like
along
this.
The way.
Yeah. But it's also interesting to me, I've met other relief vets that don't have contracts, and they just kind of go for it, and that's crazy.
So what do you think the biggest misconception about being a veterinarian is out there?
That we just get to play with puppies and kittens, and we get to just love animals all day long and do fun things with them.
See, my thing is everyone always asks me to express their dog's anal glands. I thought that was awesome.
No.
All my friends, they tell me, hey, did you bring your glove? My dog's been
scooting.
You're
kidding.
No.
Like you're at a dinner party.
Yeah.
You
got to understand, you choose your friends, and my friends are just as immature and obnoxious as I am. So we have fun. We try to embarrass our kids. We try to embarrass our spouses. That's just what we do.
Oh, my God. That's actually... pretty hilarious.
Right. Well, I mean, the one thing you never want to do is go to a party and let people know that you are a veterinarian.
Oh, learned that. Yes, very early on.
So what's your go-to job, if profession, if they ask you?
You know, that's so funny. I've been talking to my husband about this, and I've never come up with anything that good. I was thinking real estate agent for a while, but then I feel like people ask me questions about that. What is something, please help me come up with something that
IRS auditor.
Oh. Yeah, nobody likes that.
No one likes that. That one shuts people up pretty quick. Or, okay. You know, you just like, you know, just find some boring job.
Accountant? Yeah. But then people ask you about taxes. Yeah.
You can't be professional. It has to be like some like mid-level white collar job that you know.
I've really been brainstorming on this because we've met people, you know, on vacation or something. Oh my God, let me show you the picture of my dog and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, I don't care. I mean, I do. Your dog's adorable, but I don't need to talk to you.
I'm on my time off right now.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that is something, too. I don't know if this happens outside of this profession, but people expect you to be on all the time. DMs on Instagram, on the TikTok, calling you at ungodly hours, like, oh, my God, my dog's vomiting. What do? People I haven't heard from since high school, you know? Oh, my gosh, something's going on with my cat. Please help.
And they don't even bring their cat to you.
No.
They go to their vet. Never seen a cat. Mm-hmm. They that happens a lot. They were like, oh, I just took my dog to my vet and he said this. Mm-hmm. What would you do?
Yeah.
Okay. I have no problem texting really quick. I think that's what I would do. Right. And do they bring it to me to do it? No, they go back to their vet.
Yeah. They just want free advice.
Yeah. Well, free advice isn't bad, but you know.
Yeah. But, or like free diagnoses too.
Right.
What's going on with my dog? You know, I don't know. I'm not there.
Right.
You know, it's, yeah, I don't know. Maybe that does happen in other professions. I haven't heard
of it. I got one. I just thought of one. Just say you do PR for a church.
No, because then if they're religious or something, they'll say,
well, I'm just thinking,
oh my gosh, what church do you belong to?
The Seventh-day Adventist. Just do something that like no one knows anything about and you're good. You know, you just make that up. You know, I don't know, but you got to be very careful about telling people what you do.
Yeah.
Because the free advice problem is a problem.
Yeah.
And you don't have time to shut off.
And it is, I know it sounds so minimal, like, oh, why can't you just tell me what your favorite dog food brand is? But there's so much of it when you're off. You know, I just actually went to a wellness retreat for veterinarians in Mexico. It was a continued education about mental well-being and mental health. And she said something that has just stuck with me, where when you're off, you know, everybody has the Facebook group that they're on, that they're just reading through stuff. Oh, that's a cool case.
Like women vets, mommy vets, all those. Yes.
Vets without kids, you know? There's all these groups. There's relief veterinarians, California veterinarians. You know, there's all this stuff that even when you're just scrolling, you know, at home, that's supposed to be this mindless scroll, you're working to some degree. You're
try to be married to a veterinarian.
That's right. Duh.
Right.
Yeah,
because
that's constant.
Then it's like, oh, I saw this case, and you're just sitting there like, you're like, okay, honey, what is it? You know, but you're just like in the back of your mind.
Yeah.
Wow, I really can't do this for another 2 hours. Mm-hmm. Like I just did it for 10, 11.
Yeah.
So
how do you guys deal with that? You just kind of have to shut it down.
I talk about setting the boundaries. I always help her. And but she's also the type that, like, I give her advice, and she's like, oh, I'm not going to do that. Mm. And finally, I had to have that, you know, sit-down talk, which is like, and especially mentor-mentee relationship. Like, if the mentor gives you some coaching advice, you don't have to follow it, but be like, okay, yeah, that sounds good. I'll think about it. You don't have to follow it, but don't be like, no, I'm not going to do that. Because that mentor is finally going to put up their middle finger at you, and then all of a sudden you're like, oh, I don't have a mentor. Well, no, you had a mentor. Mm-hmm. You just didn't have the enough emotional intelligence to accept what it is.
Right.
You got to learn how to talk to them.
Yeah.
And make them realize that they're because their time is valuable as well. Mm-hmm. They don't want to be sitting there spitting out Merck manual to you.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden you're like, oh, no, I'm just going to go down this absolutely other path. And when that other path doesn't work, what is the mentor supposed to do? Like, I told you so? I mean, you don't have mentors like that. They're kind of like, okay, well, let's see if we can fix it.
Yeah, but being married, that's a whole nother, you know, bag of bones.
Yeah, it is. It is. So, you know, we've talked about how emotionally challenging this profession is.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a specific go-to strategy for difficult situations?
I think for me, it's more of when I'm off, really pouring back into myself. And I'm still learning that. But I think in the moment, I kind of just, you know, I'm coasting, you know, I'm doing what I need to do at work. And then I'm processing more as I'm alone and just kind of giving myself more time to do things that I want to do that fill my cup.
Okay, so two questions. Number one, since you're doing relief now,
mm-hmm.
and I'm not asking this in a mean way, but mm-hmm. since you don't have skin in the game, mm-hmm. right? Those aren't your clients. That's not your practice. Do you feel as if that took a lot off your plate?
Yes. 1,000,000%. It's relief with relief. Because I will say, fully taking accountability, but I created such high maintenance clients where I was so available that they expected me to be responding to them
immediately.
Yeah, at 9 p.m., 3 a.m. Oh my gosh, I'm in the ER with Fluffy, blah, blah, blah. Like, what do you, you know, and even just wanting like emotional help in those moments. And I think that was a huge, not I think, I know, that was a massive realization for me by my third hospital and realizing that kept happening.
That you train your clients.
I do.
Every veterinarian out there trains the type of client.
Yeah.
If you have very difficult clients, it's because you've allowed them to be that way. You've mm-hmm. allowed them to dictate the conversation.
Yeah.
You have allowed them to define the boundaries. You have allowed them to be that type of act in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
Like a lot of my associates, I have a couple that were like that, and God bless them, because there are clients that need that handholding.
Mm-hmm.
They do. But when those clients, they get all that handholding and they walk out of their room and they're totally disrespectful to the staff, that's like a red flag. They got to go, and they wouldn't let them go. They wouldn't go. They never would call them out on their behavior to the receptionist, to the kennel attendants, to the technicians, to the assistants. And that is not okay.
It's not.
You need to stand up for your staff.
Mm-hmm.
But I love the fact that you brought up, you realize you trained your clients.
1,000,000%. It's 100% me.
So looking back at you now, right, mm-hmm. what would you tell yourself coming out of school?
That veterinarian is not your entire identity. There's more to you than that. And you need work-life balance. And it's okay to ask for time off.
So let's talk about professional identity, because it's based on your values. If your number one value is work-life balance, is clinical medicine the right realm of veterinary medicine for you?
Yeah, that's actually a very, very good question. The really beautiful thing about getting a DVM degree is you can do a lot with it. There's a lot of different ways you can be a veterinarian. I think as a relief vet, it's a lot more achievable with the work-life balance. I make my own schedule. I travel as much as I want. You know, in August, I'm not going to be working at all this year. So, and that makes it more fun for me too, because I've had so much time off that I almost want to get back to it. But other jobs that I have kind of explored, you know, working for, you know, IDEX or working for some kind of drug company and being, you know, more of the doctor for that situation, I would miss the clinical piece and working hands-on with the cats and dogs. So, but hey, if you have any options.
Well, I
or
wish
other things.
I know. I mean, there's. I wish I had. I don't even know how to even make the like. I think during COVID, the coolest thing about COVID was clients had to wait in the car.
Oh yeah.
And we were so efficient. We were so happy.
Yeah.
Even though we were seeing like 60, 70, 80, 90 cases a day sometimes because none of the other clinics were accepting new patients. And I'm like, animals don't choose when they get sick.
Yeah.
If they need to be seen, they need to be seen. I, as far as that goes, I think for me, that was amazing.
Yeah.
So how do you make a practice model that follows that and it's next to impossible? Like there's some new corporate clinics that the owner's there for every step of the way. And I forget, you know, there's a couple that do that. I don't think I could handle that.
No.
I could not. I mean, I even had a hard time with my technicians doing rectal temps in the room.
Yeah, or placing a catheter on a 19-year-old cat.
That's in, you know, about 12% dehydrated and renal failure and has hyperthyroidism.
Yeah, and you, I mean, as an especially, you know, say it's a euthanasia situation, it's already traumatic enough. It's so emotional. As an owner, you don't really want to see your cat being poked a million times. But they go, no, please don't take my cat away from me in these final moments, you know? Mm-hmm. But they don't understand that, really, you don't want to see this, I promise. It's not that, you know, we're doing anything horrific to them, but it is traumatic, and people don't like blood, you know? They don't like needles, so.
They don't like to see it. And I don't care how good you are at placing a catheter.
Mm-hmm.
Doing it in front of an owner, that's an art. It's an art. It's an art. It's
the
hard to do.
The stakes are high.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. You're shaking. I know. Yeah, and I mean, and especially for, I understand like for the, like the euthanasia, if they want the animal there, sedate the pet heavily.
Yeah.
Always just be option. Like, give it. I used to do a shot of Torbinase for a dog, for example. And I'm like, okay, here's some ice cream. Here's some chocolate bars.
Oh,
here's
bless.
All this stuff.
Love that.
And I'm like, we'll be back in 10 minutes. And of course, the ice cream would be gone, and the owners would be like, wow, they really love that. And I'm like, oh, he, you know, your animal looks like, you know, they're ready. And he's like, it would take part of that edge off because I know personally I could not ever allow my dog to be taken in back, especially at that time, to get that catheter placed.
Yeah.
I personally couldn't do that.
Yeah.
So I put myself in their shoes.
Yeah.
And another thing I can't handle is if an animal is dropped off for surgery, call that owner immediately as soon as they're up or as soon as they're out of surgery. Have someone do it. Or even nowadays, you're able to text them from the computer softwares.
Yeah.
Those owners are on pins and needles.
Yeah.
Waiting. And that's all part of those soft skills I'm trying to, you know, it creates a much better client relationship with the veterinarian.
Yeah. Communication is everything.
It builds the trust that you need.
For sure.
Going back to your off time, what do you like to do to reset the engine?
Well, I do love to travel. I know I mentioned that a couple of times. I want to see the world and experience all these different cultures, but I also just love reading a lot. I love to read. I find it very soothing. I just got into sourdough baking. That's a rabbit hole. But I find a lot of joy in that too. And it takes multiple hours using my hands. So yeah, stuff like that. I also just really love doing wellness activities. I meditate, going to sound baths. My husband and I got a cold plunge at our house now. We're working on getting a sauna, just kind of doing some nice things for myself that feel calm and relaxing and peaceful.
Yeah, it could be anything.
Yeah.
Do you ever go out with friends to get dinner, drinks, stuff like
friends.
That? Yeah, you have friends.
I do have friends.
You only go out, though, with the friends that will not talk to you about being a veterinarian.
Yeah, and I've had to set a couple hard boundaries with friends around that, too, and... But they also understand because I do you know, talk about this regularly that I feel like I can't turn off. And, you know, none of them being my clients anymore has been helpful as well.
Because you're relief.
Yeah.
You don't know where you're going to be.
Which that too, not having friends, family, friends of, you know, neighbors, blah, blah, coming in, so much pressure relief as well.
If you're going to give one piece of advice to any veterinary student that's listening to this, mm-hmm. what would it be?
Find a purpose outside of veterinary medicine.
I love that. Did you ever think of working for shelter rescues, doing stuff that way?
I have thought about it. The only thing that does worry me from an emotional standpoint is since they don't always have the resources to do everything, I would have a hard time emotionally with, you know, not being able to not always be able to take care of what they need, you know, just resource wise.
But that's where you get to, that's where you truly get to use your training.
Yeah.
Like, what's the most cost effective way I can make sure that this shelter animal gets adopted?
But then I'll also probably have to do surgery and I don't want to.
I'm not talking about spays and neuters. I mean, it's a lot of fun. I mean, and honestly, I think if anything, shelter animals need the most help out of any animal out there mm-hmm. because
I'd
they need to
probably adopt every single one, and then I'm going to
need
a farm.
Foster fails are a given. We have our farm due to foster fails, but you know, I've been bequeathed many animals when the owners die. Mm. Because they know that either I would take them, one of my staff would take them, mm-hmm. or we would find an amazing home for them. Mm-hmm. So let's end on a little lightning round. You ready?
Dun, dun, dun.
Would you rather treat a lion with a toothache or a mean-ass chihuahua?
Oh. Lion with a toothache, for sure.
Yeah, I agree with that
one. I don't like getting bit.
Would you rather sit there and talk about a bill for an hour with a client or remove 100 foxtails from a dog?
Foxtails all the way.
Foxtails all the way?
I love finding those foxtails.
But you don't find them all the time.
I know, it's true. It's true. You don't. But when you do, the glory.
Yeah.
So good.
Would you go back and do it all over again?
No. I wouldn't.
You're not the only veterinarian that would say that.
Yeah, I wouldn't.
Yeah. It and that's unfortunate.
Yeah.
It is, because it is an amazing profession. And then that's why I'm doing what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I'm studying what I'm studying. Mm-hmm. Because I want you to realize how amazing this profession is. It really is. It's absolutely awesome.
Mm-hmm.
And you can have a lot of fun doing it.
Yeah.
It's not easy, but the good times, 1,000%. outweigh the bad times. But the problem is, as humans, we only remember the bad times.
It's so true. Negative bias.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I'm going to have you on again.
Okay.
And I think the mental health piece is huge.
Yeah.
What was the name of that mental health retreat you went on?
Ooh. It's called Veterinary Wellness Retreats. It's ran by this awesome woman named Shetty. She's an Australian. She lives on a sailboat, and she runs them in Mexico, Fiji, and Costa Rica right now. But highly recommend to any veterinarian.
Was it well attended? Or
I think there were about 18 of us. But the resort holds that many people. So.
Oh, it was fully booked.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Make sure you look that up. That sounds awesome. Mm-hmm. I mean. I would love to go to Fiji for a veterinary conference, because then it's tax deductible.
Correct.
And that's another little business piece.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure you take care of yourself. Make sure you take care of your mind. Make sure you take care of your family. Those always come first. This profession is amazing. It will take its toll on you, but it is rewarding at the end. Trust me on that one. And we'll talk to you next time. Thanks.